First thing I kind of worked on when I got here was with Neelam, and that was the Crystal Weimer case. And it was incredibly powerful to be in the courtroom when that expert recanted his testimony from trial and said that my opinion now is not what it had been at trial, and I should not have essentially testified to what I testified to. And to know that Crystal was going to get relief in that moment was pretty darn compelling.
Hi, this is Brooke, and you're listening to the Actual Innocence Podcast, a podcast that helps to bring awareness to those who have been wrongfully convicted. This is the second part of the Pennsylvania Innocence Project series. So if you haven't listened to the first part, you might want to go back and do that first. Next week, I will be interviewing an exoneree from the Pennsylvania Innocence Project. I am so thrilled to bring you the people who make the Pennsylvania Innocence Project possible. Once again, I want to thank the Pennsylvania Innocence Project for their hospitality. This series of episodes would not have been possible without their support. I also want to recommend that next time you're in Philly, that you get into your local car service and ask them the best place to get a cheesesteak, and go there. Just do it. You won't be sorry. This episode is being brought to you by two sponsors. That means in March, with the help of my friend and supporter, Agent KO from Twitter, I will make it to and be able to attend the Innocence Network conference. I might be sleeping in the hotel lobby, but that's just details. Before I introduce the sponsors, I want to put out one more plea. I found out recently that through your amazingly awesome and generous donations, you've raised enough money for one of the gentlemen, Clarence, John, or Calvin, to attend the Innocence Conference. So this is my final plea. If you haven't been able to already, or if you've been meaning to and forgotten, please text HELPER, HELPER, to 91999 to help get them to the conference. Because even if I'm sleeping on the couch, I will feel terrible if I'm there and the true heroes are not. If every listener could donate $1, they would all be able to go. And who knows, I might even get to sleep in a bed. All kidding aside, you guys are amazing. And I know that you always come through. So thank you so much. If you follow me on social media, you'll know that I babysit some adorable little girls. The thing is that behind those little girls is their amazing, hardworking, and sometimes stressed out mother. I decided the other day to order her a Bloom handcrafted bouquet and leave it for her as a surprise. I mean, it took me less than 2 minutes to order, and the flowers were so beautiful, and she deserved it, but she would have never bought it for herself. Nicole, my friend, looked at the flowers and cried, like literal tears. They were just what a hardworking mommy needed to show that she was appreciated. She was so thankful, and she even said, "These are so gorgeous. They make me feel like a rich person." Not only did she love them, but I felt amazing by helping her to feel amazing and appreciated. I'm used to companies that have so many hidden fees. You know, your $30 deal can turn into your $60 ripoff. But Bloom That didn't have any hidden fees. I was also happy to find out that the flowers that I ordered were the flowers that she got. When you order your Valentine's Day flowers, you don't want to trust your business to a company that cuts corners. Even though Bloom That is already a great value for premium flowers at amazing prices, because I love them so much, they've agreed to this exclusive offer just for my listeners. But act fast, because it's for this week only. You can get a gorgeous arrangement, hand-designed, Instagram-ready, plus a premium designer vase that costs everyone else, but not you, $15, plus handmade caramel treats. I kind of want one right now. That's a huge savings of around $25, and it's the best deal they're offering. You can only get this exclusive deal by going to bloomthat.com/actual. So to take advantage of this amazing deal, go to bloomthat.com, that's bloomthat.com/actual, and find the perfect handcrafted designer flowers. You'll get the premium designer vase and caramel treats and a $25 savings. Again, that's bloomthat.com/actual for a premium design bouquet that your significant other wants, but wouldn't buy for themselves and definitely deserves. Plus, you get the free vase and treats. So don't wait. This amazing offer won't last long, and it's only available to my listeners at bloomthat.com/actual. Please give a shout out to Bloom That on Facebook or Twitter at the handle @BloomThat and thank them for sponsoring the show. Again, I struggled with all of the fantastic information that I've been able to collect on how exactly to bring it to you in an organized fashion. What seemed to fit best in the first segment of this episode was to introduce the cast of characters and the various paths that had led them to the Pennsylvania Innocence Project that is now ultimately located on the third floor of Temple University. I'm going to let the players introduce themselves and tell their unique stories of becoming part of the project. In the last episode, we heard about Yvonne and her journey to becoming a paralegal and then on to the project. And this week, we're going to start with another familiar voice, Marissa, the legal director of the Pennsylvania Innocence Project.
I was a public defender for about 10 years here in Philadelphia. I also worked for a short period of time for one of the larger firms, Duane Morris, which is actually now one of our big pro bono partners here. I worked in the litigation department there. So, but it was defenders, then Duane Morris, then defenders. So it was about 10 years as a public defender, and I tried hundreds, thousands of cases from drug possession, shoplifting, all the way through homicides.
What made you want to switch to wrongful conviction?
Yeah, it was a weird, perfect storm of timing, I think. So when I was at the Defenders, I was at the Defender Association of Philadelphia, and I was working in the appeals unit for the last few years. And I had started working on the first issue that related to wrongful convictions directly was on eyewitness identification. So I was trying a case. I would try cases even though I was in the appeals unit because I like trying cases. So I would get ones that were particularly tricky that needed some special attention, maybe special investigation, or if I had different legal. So I was trying probably about, I don't know, 6 jury trials a year while in the appeals unit. These series of cases brought to my attention a gentleman named Benjamin Walker. Benjamin had been charged with, I think, 4 armed robberies around University of Pennsylvania and Drexel University in West Philadelphia. And they were all eyewitness identification. Like, that was all the evidence they had against him. There was no other evidence than witnesses who had looked at photo arrays, made identification, and then that was it. That was the entire case. So I knew that looking at them, frankly, 3 of them we would probably win, but the 4th one, I thought Benjamin probably would be convicted of, even though I really believed he didn't commit the crime. So we started trying to look at legal issues we could build in for him to pursue on appeal. And so one of the issues that we looked at was that Pennsylvania at the time was, and I think 2, maybe 3 states that did not allow at all experts to come into trial to talk about eyewitness identifications to juries. So we know eyewitness identifications is a major factor in convicting the innocent, and yet people don't understand how eyewitnesses can get it wrong, right? Because there's no expert, and it goes completely counter to everything that we think, right? Most of us think, oh, memory's like a videotape, and you can remember everything perfectly and replay it time. Not true. In fact, it's much more like a Wikipedia page, right? Like, just information can come in And if the editor's not paying attention, which of course they're not, memories can actually change over time. Jurors don't understand that. They don't understand that if there's a weapon present, that can reduce the reliability and accuracy of the memory as it's being created. So we decided with Benjamin to ask for an expert. So we said, you know what, Judge? This is an eyewitness identification only case. We should be able to provide expert testimony to the jury because they don't understand these concepts. And we need that in order to present his full defense. Well, we were denied that, of course. Benjamin was convicted, and we appealed that to the Pennsylvania Superior Court, which is the first intermediary court in Pennsylvania. Got a favorable but ultimately dinged opinion, which said, yeah, you know, we kind of think you're right, but the law is very clear. You cannot do this. So we appealed it to this Pennsylvania Supreme Court. And right after it was accepted for aliquotter, which is what we call the grant of appeal in Pennsylvania. So once aliquotter was granted on that issue, right, should Pennsylvania allow expert testimony regarding eyewitness identifications at trial, then I started hearing that the Pennsylvania Innocence Project was starting. And at first I was like, well, you know, I'm kind of interested in this, because by then I was also working in issues related to false confessions and forensic science error. But I figured I'm not qualified for that. Like, I've never run anything. I've only supervised in a very limited way. That's really not my thing. But I kept getting emails from friends who would say, no, you really should think about this. So I put in my resume and I put in my application, and for better or for worse, they hired me. So I left the defenders right when that case was being considered in the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. We wound up writing what's called an amicus brief, a friend of the court brief, with the Innocence Network, which is a loose affiliation of all the innocence organizations worldwide. And the Pennsylvania Supreme Court reversed 40 years of precedent based on that. Yeah. And so now in Pennsylvania, you can present eyewitness expert testimony because of the case that I tried as a defender. So it kind of all comes back full circle.
Next, we're going to hear from some new voices with a little experience, but a lot of heart and a lot of importance in the smooth functioning of the Pennsylvania Innocence Project.
So my name is Amanda Cookman. I am currently a 3L at Temple Law School, and I've been working at the Innocence Project for one semester last year, and then I came back on to do guided research with Marissa to continue to stay involved in the Innocence community.
So for us social workers in the audience, what is a 3L?
It is a third-year law student. So we're in our last year. So law school's 3 years, so we're graduating in May. So it's our last semester.
Hi, I'm Tiffany Kuberschmidt. I'm also a 3L at Temple Law. I've been doing this for about 2.5 years, working with the Innocence Project. I got involved after my first year of law school because I wanted to help people, and it was always something I was interested in. And once you meet Marissa and Neelam and TC and everyone else here, you don't leave, and you just want to keep helping. So it's great to be involved and get to do a lot of different interesting work.
Yeah, I just talked to Marissa for about an hour, so I'm ready to sign up. Yeah, I think I'm going
to yeah. Exactly. She has that effect on people.
So can you just kind of tell me what made you decide you wanted to go to law school?
So I actually am kind of in a unique, fortunate position, but I'm actually an active duty Army officer.
Awesome.
So I was serving down in Georgia at Fort Stewart, and there's this program, it's called the Funded Legal Education Program. So I've always been involved in public interest and helping people and being involved, so I wanted to take that route and stay in the Army, but then go to law school. So then I applied, and now ended up at Temple. So when I graduate, I'll go back into the Army as a JAG attorney.
And I kind of didn't know what I wanted to do after college, and had always wanted to help people, and with my mom continually telling me to go to law school, I applied, and then I was able to luckily find some ways to get involved in helping through Temple and through the Pennsylvania Innocence Project. And it's directed me to want to pursue a career in public interest, whether it be helping children or helping people who have innocence claims or whatever it may be. That's stayed my focus throughout law school.
So I have a lot of listeners who want to go to law school and they want to do innocence work. What advice might you offer them? Like, what path do you think they should take to get there?
I think the first step is, once you get to law school, reaching out and looking for the opportunities. So I had known that I loved working with innocence type things or reading about it or doing research papers on it from undergrad. And the first time I saw that the Pennsylvania Innocence Project had a summer internship, it was the first and only thing I applied for and was really excited to get it. And then once I got here, I continued to make relationships and take courses, take a practicum, volunteer, help in whatever way I can so that I'm building up my skills when it comes to innocent work.
I would second that response. I think I would just add to it that the biggest thing with law school is taking advantage of all opportunities that law school has to offer, and not only the ones that are listed on the course schedule, it's also knowing that you can kind of make your own curriculum and seeking out opportunities that you know are important to you when you start law school. So I think that going to Temple, we got really fortunate of the fact that the Innocence Project is actually partnered, but it's actually headquartered at Temple Law School, and they've recently opened an office in Pittsburgh. So I think that if you know that your passion is definitely working with innocence, I would kind of maybe pick tailor which law school you want to go to see if there's an Innocence Project nearby. But with that, most Innocence Projects offices don't have as many attorneys and staff, so they really rely on students to do a lot of the groundwork for them. So I would just say, know that law school is about opportunities and making those opportunities available to you.
After talking to the interns, I realized that it didn't matter what level of legal experience that you had, but that everyone felt a sense of satisfaction through their contributions to the Pennsylvania Innocence Project. I interviewed two staff attorneys who will be introducing themselves shortly, and I regret that I didn't get to talk with Liz, the attorney at the Pittsburgh office, but I hope to arrange an interview with her before the Pennsylvania Innocence Project special is over. We're going to start with my talk with the senior staff attorney.
My name's Neelam Sangvi, and I'm the senior staff attorney at the Pennsylvania Innocence Project. I've been here since July of 2013, so about 3.5 years.
And what was your path to get here? You had a really great career. So what led you here?
Yeah, so it was sort of a long and winding road. So I graduated law school in 2002, so I've been out for a while. I had been at a law firm just across the street here, actually in town, Schneider Harrison, where my husband still works. And, you know, it's a great litigation firm. I was doing a lot of appellate work, which I love to do. And they're fabulous because they do a lot of pro bono work. And one of the cases, and so I did some prisoner civil rights cases about like prison conditions while I was there. And one of the cases I was really lucky to work on when I was there was we actually represented somebody in a criminal homicide trial in the Philadelphia County Court here, which is unusual for law firms to get involved in, like, murder trials. It doesn't happen very often. It was a great experience and kind of got me even more interested in sort of this world of criminal law. And my husband and I were both partners at the firm and had decided from kind of just an interest perspective and a work-life balance perspective that it probably wasn't going to be sustainable long-term for both of us to keep up that kind of, like, intense workload. So the firm was kind enough to let me take a sabbatical, and I actually went down to D.C. and did a 2-year teaching fellowship at Georgetown, where I'd gone to law school in a clinical program that did all pro bono appeals. So all kinds of appeals for people who couldn't afford a lawyer. And I'd actually been a student in the program in law school and then went back as like an attorney and one of the professors that taught it. And it was great because it gave me the chance to see whether I really wanted to transition to public interest full time. And I loved it, and I loved the teaching aspects of it and working with the law students on actual cases. So when we were thinking about moving, and my husband was lucky enough to be able to just transfer to the DC office of the firm. So when we were thinking about moving back to Philadelphia, one of the partners at the firm is actually on the board here at the Pennsylvania Innocence Project. And I was saying, I'm not sure what I'm going to do, if I'm going to come back to the firm. And he said, you need to apply for this job. Because my predecessor had just recently learned that her husband he's a doctor and gotten a fellowship in Massachusetts, and so they were relocating to Boston. So Sam sent me the job description, and I applied, and the rest was history. It was like once I met Richard and Marissa, and you know, I had been actually at the launch event for the project in 2009 when I was still at the firm, so I'd always known about it, you know, and been supportive, and you know, known that this partner of mine was on the board, and it really has been great. It brings together kind of a lot of my interests in terms of the type of litigation I like to do and the teaching, and then obviously the work is so, you know, incredibly gratifying.
And next, we'll hear from another attorney on the staff of the Pennsylvania Innocence Project.
My name is T.C. Tansky, and I am a staff attorney with the Pennsylvania Innocence Project. I have been here about a year and 6 months now.
What led you to want to be an attorney for people who have been wrongly convicted?
So I actually started with a small private criminal defense firm in the middle of the state where I was doing criminal appeals and what we call post-conviction or PCRA work under Pennsylvania. It was my entire book of business. I had attended a conference in New Orleans. It was a conference for appellate defenders, so it involves essentially public defenders from all over the country. They come together for this conference and they bring a case and you work that case up as you would writing an appeal. How do you tell a story better? How do you work your facts in a way that is persuasive to courts? And the second time that I had attended this conference, I had the privilege of meeting a few lawyers from here in Philadelphia who are with the federal defenders. So they work on habeas cases, things outside of state court, obviously. And I introduced myself to them. We got to know each other a little bit, and at one point they had sent me this job posting and said that you should apply. I should caveat this that I had a little bit of exposure to the project prior to coming here in that I worked on a case for a man who was incarcerated for 34 years. His name was James Hugney. I was part of the team that got him relief and released from prison as part of all that. And so my first interaction with Neelam was actually her sending me some pleadings to kind of work off of and learning from her in that respect. So I applied, and I was very lucky to obviously end up here. But I think what drew me to the project, that it's a little different from most, is my desire to work on very complex cases. I think we get a lot of people, who I've seen this in my short time here, who are very mission-driven, and I totally respect that. And obviously, it is very easy to get swept up into. I would be remiss to say if I have not. For me, however, my driving force was to move up from some of the cases you might see in private criminal defense practice to some of the most complex cases I think you'll find in sort of that criminal defense realm. So I feel very lucky to be here and to be learning from Neela and Marissa and all of the lawyers that we work with, given my relatively junior status, as it may be.
The next person you're going to meet is Zach, who you might remember because he so kindly and unknowingly loaned me his office on the first day. Zach is not an attorney. He's an investigator, which instantly made me think of Kalinda from The Good Wife. I'm pretty sure that comparison couldn't be farther from the truth. But I'm going to let you form your own opinion.
My name is Zach Stern. I'm the investigator with the Pennsylvania Innocence Project.
How did you get here? Like, what was your journey to becoming the investigator?
Before I was here, I was an investigator at a defense office in northern Florida that represented folks on death row in their post-conviction proceedings. And I was really interested in the guys who had serious innocence claims, and really enjoyed investigating those and speaking with like fact witnesses, and wanted to, you know, maybe like focus a little bit more on that. In a lot of those cases, I was doing mostly mitigation investigation. So like, you know, getting school records, speaking with teachers, principals, family members, anyone who knew like anything about our clients, which I love that too. But I just wanted to focus more on guilt phase. So when I saw the Pennsylvania Innocence Project opening, you know, I was pretty excited. And I guess just like more generally how I got interested in the work. Before I was in Florida, I was in southern Louisiana, and I was working with an attorney who represented chronically homeless folks in SSI and Social Security disability cases, and just like became interested in like advocating for, you know, indigent people who were sort of thrown around system after system, and in this case, you know, criminal justice system.
I don't know if you'd noticed the same theme as I did while listening to all of these interviews, but all of these contributors to the cause aren't just there because of heart, but most of them cited a specific case or type of people that made the transition into the Innocence Project work natural for them. And I think that that is totally admirable. We're going to find out more about the Innocence Project, the team, and like I mentioned in the last episode, their work with local law enforcement to help reduce wrongful convictions. First, though, we're going to talk about Sherry's Berries. And I need to put out a disclaimer. I have not yet made it through reading the description of these berries without my mouth watering and a serious craving. So you might want to pull up their website, berries.com, and get your order ready to go. Sherry's Berries are gifts like no other, for your love like no other. I love my mom, and as a matter of fact, I have an infinity tattoo of her name on my foot. Though sometimes when we argue, I joke that it really says wow, and she's reading it upside down. The truth is, though, my mom has always been there for me. And I want to be there for her, too, and make her feel appreciated. This year, I decided that I was going to do that by sending her Sherry's Berries for Valentine's Day as a reminder of how sweet she is. But first, you know, of course, I had to order some for myself to make sure they were, good enough for her. The offer was freshly dipped strawberries from Sherry's Berries, starting at just $19.99, plus shipping, or double the berries, totally worth it, for just $10 more. I just went to berries.com and used my code AI, like actual innocence, AI. Plus, getting these delicious berries is supporting the show through supporting our sponsor. So be sure you use the code AI. So let's talk about these berries. They were huge, like amazingly huge. Decadent, fresh, juicy, and oh so irresistible. I got to choose what kind of chocolate they were dipped in and also the decorative toppings. Let me tell you, they were amazing and are definitely good enough for my mom. With Valentine's Day around the corner, there's only one way to get Sherry's Berries starting at $19.99. Just visit berries.com. That's berries.com. Click on the microphone on the top right-hand corner of the page and type in AI. That's berries.com. And use my code AI to help support our show by supporting our sponsors. Remembering to use my code AI is really important. Also, feel free to give Sherry's Berries a shout out on Facebook or Twitter at Sherry's Berries. That's @SHARRISBERRIES. And thank them for sponsoring the show. And of course, send them pictures of your delicious goodies. You might remember from the last episode that it all started with two women, a man, and some desks in the middle of a room. That vision inspired me to ask the Innocence team what their first days were like. I decided to go in what I believe is chronological order. We're going to start with Neelam.
Do you remember what your first day was like?
Yeah, actually, my first day was a little crazy, and Liz will have a similar story for you when you ask her about her first day. But my first day was July 15th of 2013, which was the first day of the evidentiary hearings for our clients, Eugene Gilliard and Lance Felder, in their motion to get a new trial. So my first day was in court, kind of watching this hearing and trying to get up to speed and give whatever, you know, support I could. And Charlotte, it was the staff attorney before me, was still, you know, handling that hearing with some pro bono lawyers who were working on it with us. And that hearing kind of continued. We had a few days, you know, in July, a few days, and it continued for the next couple of months. And it ultimately led to Eugene and Lance being exonerated. So it was a pretty good first day of work.
Then I talked to TC about his first day.
So what was your first day here like?
Yeah, so my first day here, I was very lucky in that I came in when they were moving and after they had moved, so I was never in the old office. And so when I came in, everything had been moved in, it was nice and easy. I have a little bit of benefit in that I had some experience with these proceedings and procedure, so it wasn't so much as that, it was more learning office policies and procedures, learning how do we file when I put something into our computer drives, how do I name it? How do I represent myself to other organizations? How do I represent myself to media, for example? What is okay to say? What is not okay to say? And I think I was inundated with new information, particularly in the DNA realm, because you do not get exposed a lot to that from my limited experience. And so taking a lot of that information on DNA through osmosis over a period of time has certainly been a learning process. And I think I can talk about these things a little more competent than I could in the beginning, but that is why we try and get experts where we can. When I look back on my first day, though, relatively, it's like any first day, kind of unremarkable, just in terms of memory. But I do remember the biggest learning curve being just the office ins and outs, more or less, than the actual law. That can kind of come in time with itself. Not to say, though, things have not, you know, there's always challenges no matter how you're fitting in.
The interns, Amanda and Tiffany, shared their very different first days.
So what was your first day like?
I got this crazy case. So the first day is a lot about confidentiality. So you have to sign a ton of, just because they don't want everyone's name getting out there. It's a very big process of deciding whether you're even going to take on a case. You don't want to get someone's hopes up and everything like that. But I got this case that was pretty emotional, and it was a little overwhelming, but there's a lot of uncertainty involved about it. And it's a lot of reading about a case file and deciding, because basically it's up to you to brief Marissa whether you think this person's claim of innocence is legitimate or not. So it's a huge responsibility. So it was exciting. I was excited my first day, and I worked on that case the entire semester. So
it was
a pretty cool experience.
What was your first day like?
Well, I got lucky that my first day happened to be moving day for the Innocence Project one campus to the other. So I basically just came in and helped organize files and put things where they needed to go. So that was my first day. But then the second day was more being assigned a case, and I worked on that case for definitely the whole summer and a little bit going into the semester to try and do the initial report that we write.
And lastly, we'll hear about Zach and his non-Kalinda-like investigation.
Do you remember what your first day was like?
Uh-huh.
You know, I get scary. That look every time I ask that question.
I mean, just the lawyers in our office are really experienced and really impressive. So I'm 26 and I'm not impressive and I'm not experienced, so I was pretty intimidated and like still am. But I think that's like maybe a good thing to just like keep you, I mean, it's good in terms of like just being able to learn from the folks that I'm working with. But yeah, I mean, on my first day, I remember feeling really overwhelmed. In Florida, I had 6 cases that I was working on. Here, I mean, there are new ones coming through, like, at least on a weekly basis, multiple ones on a weekly basis. And I remember my first day seeing, like, a list of, you know, 25 or 30 and just thinking, how am I going to remember who goes with what? But, I mean, as you, you know, talk with folks and read about the case, you know, you obviously just become a lot more comfortable and, like, you know, start realizing, okay, I can remember that this is this case and this is that case. But definitely overwhelmed and intimidated on my first day.
I have to smile because all of these first days sound like the experiences that I've had in most of my careers. And to think that the team at the Pennsylvania Innocence Project started out like the rest of us is comforting and inspiring in knowing that we can all make a difference. I think someday I'll probably be more comfortable in my podcasting style, but give a girl a break. This is my first series in this format, so I'm going to explain each segment to you. I had some questions for Amanda and Tiffany about their internships, as I've never interviewed interns before. And also Zach, as he's the first investigator that I even sat in a room with.
So each client is supposed to be have eventually an investigative report that details everything we know and we have about a case. And so my job was to kind of organize all of the files related to this guy's case, figure out what documents we needed. I would go to the courthouse and see if I could dig through his archived box and find other things we might be missing. So it was great that when I first got it, I was really overwhelmed. Nobody had looked at it in a while. There were a lot of different players involved in the case. And then I was able to come up with this concrete report in the end, which was really cool. So at the first, it's overwhelming. There's a lot going on. And especially when you're given cases where a person's convicted of murder or rape or some really gruesome things, but then you get to reading it and you realize they probably didn't do it. So it's overwhelming, but worth it in the end.
So how do you think that your responsibilities have increased from that first day until now?
A lot, to the point where Amanda and I are both now working with Marissa on policy things as opposed to doing some more casework and meeting with clients. So we're trying to make big picture changes to help the clients we may have instead of working on an individual case, which is just helping in a different way. And I don't think someone who would be thrown in here right away would be able to do what Marissa's asked of us to do now, but hopefully it'll still make a difference and Amanda and I can find some good research and come up with some great ideas on how to accomplish these goals.
So you're the first investigator that I've met. What kind of schooling or training, like how do you learn to be an investigator?
I have a bachelor's degree. I don't have any, I've been to multiple trainings, mitigation intensive trainings by, you know, decades long investigators or mitigation specialists. But I mean, other than being at trainings, I don't have like schooling behind it. When I was in Louisiana, I had got a lot of experience just speaking with a lot of people who sort of come from similar situations as our clients that I'm dealing with now and our witnesses now. So I just think like dealing with just like having a background and speaking with people from, you know, like widely different backgrounds, in my opinion is like, you know, something that's important for trying to be an investigator in this work. And then just like learning some like tricks with experience on like how to find people or who might be willing to talk, you know, just things like that. I mean, there's a lot of just like, you know, just trying to keep your eyes open and just like listening to people who have experience. And
do you have like a typical day?
I mean, I think like my days are like one of a couple. If I'm in the office, I'll be writing like interview reports based on interviews that I did. I'll be, you know, researching where people are, criminal histories, going over something in the file that like, you know, if I'm about to go out looking for someone or if I spoke with someone and it like triggered my, you know, thought process about something. So if I'm in the office, I'm doing like research writing in some capacity. And then a lot of days I'll be out of the office looking for witnesses, interviewing witnesses, going to prisons, interviewing our potential clients or witnesses in prisons.
Is it ever scary? Like, have you ever interviewed someone and you were like, wow, this is, like, I wish I weren't here?
No. I mean, I'm young, so, like, maybe, you know, like, I'm an older investigator may have, like, some horror stories. I mean, I've gotten, you know, but, you know, other than, like, having the door slammed in my face, you know, which is kind of to be expected, I've never, like, felt, you know, nervous or scared. I mean, people, like, I just feel like if you, you know, like, just, like, listen and treat people with respect, like, people, like, generally respond well, and, you know, they see what we're about, you know, I mean, we're the Innocence Project, we're not trying to, you know, we're not the police, and, you know, I try to make that clear, and I think, yeah, I mean, people have never been, like, threatening or, you know, anything like that. I've never felt scared, yeah.
Finally, I asked everyone if they had a moment or a case or a person that was their aha moment, the moment that really solidified to them that they were in the right field. And of course, they did.
So do you have like a most memorable case that you've worked on or one that was like, wow, that was amazing?
Well, I mean, in Florida, two cases that I was working on One was a guy who was on death row already, so he'd been convicted and sentenced, and he has an IQ in the 50s. So it's actually, like, illegal for him to be on death row for, like, an early 2000s case. Atkins, you know, folks with intellectual disabilities shouldn't, are not legally allowed to be executed, but his attorneys just, like, did not look into this at all, and they didn't even try arguing this kind of claim. Additionally, he also hasn't had, like, a very strong innocence claim. His attorneys did not look into that at all either. So by the time we got the case, we were, I mean, I spoke to a lot of family members, principals, and, like, psychologists, and we had him IQ tested, and that's when we found out his IQ was in the 50s. We got his school records. I mean, he'd been special ed his whole life, and his trial attorneys had never looked into any of this stuff, never spoke with anyone, never requested any records. And this guy is, I mean, very low functioning, really has a hard time understanding. We had him transferred to the county jail when we were there for, like, just a status conference hearing. And he thought when he went to the county jail that he was getting out. He didn't understand that he had to, you know, then go back to death row. He doesn't really understand that he's on death row. And meanwhile, then when we started looking into the, you know, the fact phases of that case, the two eyewitnesses recanted almost immediately upon meeting them, and, you know, talked about what the detectives were like in that case, just, like, very, very coercive, very, very threatening, which is a common theme in, you know, all of our cases here at the Innocence Project, for sure. And it was just, like, you know, it really stood out. I mean, it was, like, one of the first cases that I, like, really dug into. So, you know, it's probably the, you know, is the first one that comes to mind when asked that question, just in terms of how little had been done the first time around. And then this guy's sitting on death row, and it's so much harder to get a sentence overturned or a conviction overturned, much harder that than, like, just presenting it at trial and getting, you know, possibly a favorable sentence from the jury or a favorable verdict. So it was shocking to see how little had been done on, like, such an obvious mitigation intensive case and, like, fact case. I mean, right in the police report was a witness describing the shooter as being, like, 5'8", 5'9", 160 pounds. Our client was no taller than 5 feet and, like, 250 pounds. Nobody spoke to this eyewitness. So when we went and spoke to him, you know, he reiterated the same description. We showed him a picture of our client, and he said he's 100% sure that's not the guy he saw doing the shooting. So it was really amazing to see how little was done. But, you know, just speaking generally about cases here at the Innocence Project, all of our cases are like that. Florida, that was probably, I mean, more or less an anomaly. I mean, most trial attorneys didn't do the most comprehensive look into their clients' cases, and that's, you know, often why folks end up on death row. But they weren't as blatant as that one. But here, it's really been shocking to see how thin evidence can ultimately result in a life without parole sentence.
So, do you have a most memorable client?
You know, they're all memorable in really different ways, and I think every letter, even if it's a case that we can't ultimately take, reminds me of, like, why we need to be here, just to at least make sure that somebody's hearing these voices and reviewing the claims to see whether there's anything we can do or not, whether it's an innocence claim or not, because a lot of people, even if you don't ultimately help them, they've never had a lawyer at least seriously consider their side. You know, Dante's case really hit home to me because he's one of our younger clients and he's not even 30 yet. And to imagine spending, I mean, I know all of our clients, a lot of them spent those formative years in jail, but, you know, just to see him spending that time from basically like 19 to 29, you know, we really, really wanted to get him home before his 30th birthday, and that really, like, kind of resonated with me, and we were able to make it happen, which was awesome.
For sure.
And then we have, and, you know, on the flip side, another client, our client, Terry Smallwood, who went to prison in 1972 at age 20, and we secured a new trial for her in 2015.
Wow.
And she'd been in for almost 43 years at that point. And so she's kind of on the opposite end of the spectrum, where she's in her 60s, she has some health problems, but, you know, she still kept fighting all those years, and she's out on bail now. The district attorney is actually appealing the decision in her case, so she's still fighting. But, you know, through breast cancer, through kidney disease, through all of these things, she never lost faith and never stopped trying, you know, to get somebody to look at her case. And then when we did, and then finally when a judge did, you know, she finally got a good result. So it's interesting to me to think about those two cases together, because it's someone who is on the much younger side when released, but then somebody, you know, Terry was basically the same age as Dante when she went in, and it took, her journey took so much longer. So it's interesting to see the similarities and differences in terms of their reentry. I mean,
right,
because they're so different in terms of life experience and age, but still, when both of them like looked at a smartphone, they had the similar, like, what the heck is this, you know? But, you know, it's certainly, you know, the sort of their experiences and the challenges are like similar in some ways and different in other ways, which is interesting.
I've heard a lot of people who've been exonerated say that, you know, when they, there's nothing for them when they get out, you know. Mm-hmm. But are there any kind of programs in Pennsylvania for people who have been exonerated?
There is not any kind of structured, like, programs in Pennsylvania for exonerees. So we don't have any compensation for the time you've been wrongfully incarcerated, which some states do, not all.
Is there a way to get, like, can you sue for compensation? Or
technically you can file, like, federal civil rights suits and things like that, but there are a lot of barriers to doing that, because law enforcement and prosecutors in particular have what's called immunity for a lot of their conduct, so they can't be sued for certain things. So those claims are theoretically out there, but they're very difficult. And it's also, so as a legal matter, it's difficult. I also think that these people have been dealing with the court system for years and often decades, and then, you know, that's another, embarking on yet more litigation with yet more uncertainty, I think, from an emotional perspective also is right. Difficult.
Do you have a case that is most rewarding to you?
There's two. So the first one would be the one before I came here.
Okay.
His name was Mr. Hugney, 34 years for arson. He's out right now. He's doing well. And then the second one, my first thing I kind of worked on when I got here was with Neelam, and that was the Crystal Weimer case. I don't know if anybody had mentioned that yet. And it was incredibly powerful to be in the courtroom when that expert recanted his testimony from trial and said that my opinion now is not what it had been at trial, and I should not have essentially testified to what I testified to. And to know that Crystal was going to get relief in that moment was pretty darn compelling.
Wow.
I think when we have those incidents, when we have cases like Crystal, like Dante, you see him walking out of the courthouse in street clothes after 11 years, and he's in front of that news camera, and they're like, Dante, did you know your charges got dismissed? Like, oh, I didn't know about that. That is what drives us to the mess that people can't see in my office right now, but is on the computer screen, is at home when we're working late. It is the drive to get to the next one to try and correct the injustices that have happened. That is not to say that everybody who writes us is going to get help for a variety of reasons, but I think having those moments, dealing with those cases, really drive me to the next one. And hopefully 2017, knock on wood, we'll have a few more awesome results and stories to tell.
Benjamin Franklin once said that an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. And that is every bit as truthful now as it was back then. I'm going to have Marissa share with you their work towards prevention.
So I wanted to ask, I was looking at your website earlier, and there was, I need to read it because I quoted it. Preventing wrongful conviction.
Right.
You have a preventing wrongful conviction section on your website. Mm-hmm. And that was the first time I've ever seen that on an Innocence Project or an Innocence Network agency website. So what is that about?
So when we talk about, you know, wrongful convictions, it's obviously critically important to reach the people who are in prison now and get them out. That's our core. But if we're not doing anything to stop innocent people from going in, then, you know, we're really not fulfilling the main function that we all need to be doing. So what we do is I do in particular is work with law enforcement, legislators, judges, prosecutors to try to change some of the ways we investigate crime, to change some of the ways we conduct jury trials, to change some of the ways we have in the legislation to address wrongful convictions to ensure they don't happen. So with the, to go back to the eyewitness case, now we have expert testimony at trials. That's great. But if we're not running an eyewitness identification procedure in a way that is consistent with best evidence and best scientific practices, we're going to still commit the same error over and over and over again. So we've done a number of trainings with law enforcement all across the Commonwealth on how to run a photo array better, how to run a lineup, how to talk to witnesses, how not to contaminate that memory so that we preserve that human memory in its most reliable, accurate form. So here in Philadelphia, for example, I work directly with the commissioner to revise the way that we do photo arrays and lineups. And now I can say, I just had a meeting with the captain last week to kind of review the protocols, and I was complaining because there was one aspect they didn't adopt. And he said, well, where's that? I gave you 98%. What do you want? I was like, I want my other 2%. So I'm still working on that.
That's amazing, though, that he's receptive to that.
This was under Commissioner Ramsey. He was incredibly receptive to this. And Commissioner Ross has been supportive of it as well. We've also done presentations with the Pennsylvania Association of Chiefs of Police on eyewitness protocols. We're doing one this summer, hopefully, on changing the way we interview or interrogate suspects. I mean, Brandon Dassey is a key example of how you do it wrong, mm-hmm. right? How you led that poor boy into confessing, at least, at the very least, giving confession was false, whether he was involved in the crime or not. What came out of his mouth was wrong, demonstrably wrong. And there are better ways to do this. We don't need to coerce and intimidate people into giving a statement. In England, in parts of Canada, they conduct their interrogations in an entirely different way. And we're actually involved in helping to bring some of those law enforcement members here to Pennsylvania to retrain or at least suggest a different way that we can do this, right? So in England, for example, they have a method that's called PEACE, P-E-A-C-E, and it's an acronym. But they'll say to me, we used to do it your way, we were wrong. We were wrong. And you do it now in a totally different way about gathering information and not focusing in on a suspect, not assuming guilt, but trying to really get information out in a non-threatening, non-coercive, non-leading way. And they're still arresting people in England, right? They're still getting terrorists. They're still getting murderers. Their arrest rate hasn't gone down, or their conviction rate hasn't gone down a whit. But what it would eliminate here in the United States would be motions to suppress confessions. Because if you're taking away the coercive element, then it's fine. There's absolutely no reason not to. You're getting more reliable, more accurate information, which is what all of this is about. So when we talk about preventing wrongful convictions, that's really what we're talking about on the ground, changing the way police and law enforcement conduct investigations, working with prosecutors to overcome their own inherent biases that we all have as people, right? I mean, we use that word bias, and it sounds like prejudice. It's not. We're human beings.
Absolutely.
And we all process information in a way that makes us be able to get through our days. And if you're looking at information or evidence through a lens of this is the person that committed the crime, all the evidence coming in is going to be filtered through that lens, which is how we process it. So you may not see the witness statement who identifies somebody else. Very often we'll say, well, that's not a reliable statement. They were too far away. They can't have seen that. Mm-hmm. Instead of really looking at that and saying, oh, well, maybe that's right. So it's not bad cop, no donut. Right? That's not what's going on. It's not that law enforcement prosecutors want to get the wrong guy. They don't.
Right.
They don't. But they're human beings, and we look at information through a certain lens. So one thing we're trying to do is encourage more training around those bias issues.
That's amazing.
And use of checklists and use of kind of backing up and maybe having a devil's advocate around to kind of bounce ideas off of, just to try to get us in a different position so we can start looking at that. And that's something that we're seeing a lot of reception to. I just did a training on this for the Chester County District Attorney and his staff out there, and it was very well received. They happened to do a lot of the things that I was suggesting. They're willing to incorporate some more. in terms of trying to make sure that that human bias doesn't come into play in a charging decision or a jury decision or a decision to move forward. So, but it's endemic. It goes from police through prosecutors and even judges.
I have so much more information from this amazing team, and I'm really going to try and put it together in the form of a bonus episode. But next week will be the story of Dante and his wrongful conviction and exoneration by the Pennsylvania Innocence Project. Before Megan reads the credits, I wanted to remind you that you can visit innocenceprojectpa.org and see what they're all about and what they might need help with. Also, please, if you haven't had your chance yet, text HELPER, H-E-L-P-E-R, to 91999 to help send the guys to the Innocence Conference. So until next time, I'm Brooke. Thanks so much for listening.
A special thanks to our sponsors, Sherry's Berries and Bloom That, for sponsoring today's episode. Remember, if you can't financially support our sponsors, feel free to give them a shout out on social media. Visit our website, www.actualinpod.com, to see our calendar, ways to support the show, and pictures of the team and our trips to various Innocence Network agencies. The Actual Innocence podcast is produced and hosted by the wonderful Brooke Giddings, and she receives help from the most amazing volunteer team ever, Megan Delaney, Casey Sanders, and Sarah Nelson. We are so appreciative of our transcription team, Tori Lynch and Jane Ashton, whose work will be making an appearance on the website very soon. Our executive producer is Dennis Robinson, and our theme song is by Andy Cohen. Until next time, listen, learn, and advocate for justice. Thanks for listening.